welcome to World Crisis Radio. This is your host, Webster Tarpley, reporting from Washington, D.C., in our last broadcast of the old year, 2008. And we want to give a kind of year-end wrap-up and panorama of the war perspective, the international depression breakdown crisis perspective, and the domestic U.S. picture, which is one of union busting, the creation of fascist and fascistoid militias, as well as the attempt to muzzle and silence various forms of vocal opposition, possibly including many programs on this network or this network in general. But let's talk about what I think emerges as the overarching theme at the end of 2008. And it's something that people have to address, I think, in order to make sense or find a way out of any of these other crises. It is the crisis of a ruling class, the crisis of the Anglo-American ruling elite. As we see from Pakistan to Afghanistan to Iraq to Ukraine to Burma, all around the world, these people make the wrong decisions. When it comes to economics, they've bet their ranch on $1.5 trillion in derivatives, absolutely useless expenditure. Their plan to get out of that crisis, by the way, is to go further into the bottomless pit of the Malthusian swamp. They want green jobs. They want windmills and solar cells to get themselves out of the worst world economic depression that we've ever seen. Previous attempts to deal with economic stagnation have included nuclear energy programs and a space program. But this time, the ruling class is essentially at the level of decadence and degeneracy that the only thing they can see is this green stuff. And again, the windmill is a great thing, but this is a technology that goes back certainly more than 1,000 years. And the solar cell, I guess, comes from the 19th or early 20th century. We're talking about the ruling elite, the ruling class. Now, some people hear that and say, well, that sounds like Marxism. Well, guess again. If we go back to Plato in the Republic, we find a description, and this is now 2,500 years ago almost, 2,400 anyway, we find a description of the ruling class, that in an oligarchy, it is the rich who rule and the poor have no say, and that is the ruling class of an oligarchy. Plato goes on to point out that oligarchy is a constitution filled with many evils. And we're seeing them right now. Remember the historical features of oligarchy as we see them from the Greeks. The notion that the world is overpopulated. Always and by definition, the world is overpopulated. The oligarch needs this because he needs to create a situation where the average person, Joe Sixpack or whoever it is somehow an inferior species. The oligarch has the right to survive, but the others don't. They're inferior. They're oppressing the breast of Mother Earth, and therefore you've got to organize things, they say, like the Trojan War, the 10-year siege of Troy about 1000 BC. So the oligarchical idea is that the world was already overpopulated in 1000 BC. We also have the Greek historian known as the Old Oligarch, contemporary of Thucydides, again, about 400 B.C., give or take. And here the idea is the Athenian Navy is bad because the high-technology Athenian Navy, high technology for the time, is allowing a path of upward mobility to the lower orders, which threatens oligarchical privilege and therefore the basis on which the oligarchy views its own survival. The old oligarch also doesn't like the long walls, the walls that go from Athens down to Piraeus, and it prevents the Spartan oligarchical army from coming in and wiping out the Athenians. So the idea is simply that technology is bad and there are too many people. Now, in the 19th century, this is then taken up by, in the 18th century, it's taken up by Gian Maria Ortes, O-R-T-E-S, the economic charlatan and quack of Venice, who's the first person who writes about a carrying capacity for the world, 3.5 billion, I think it is, that he says, or 3 billion, and that is then copied, plagiarized by Reverend Malthus. Thomas Malthus, the theoretician of overpopulation and immiseration, is the main philosopher of the British Empire. Darwin builds immediately on Malthus. Darwin is inconceivable without Malthus. And on top of that, then you get basically fascism, because Hitler and so forth are based to a significant degree on the reading of Darwin by Nietzsche. Nietzsche says, Darwin, you haven't gone far enough. It's not just the will to survive. It's the will to power. Let's make it more radical. So that's oligarchical thinking. Now, as we look around us today, we see that the U.S.-British oligarchy is striking out on every issue. They're bungling, they're failing, and they're engaged in negative feedback. In other words, if you have a derivatives crisis, which is due to deregulation, privatization, and union busting over a 30-year period, the prescription that the oligarchy comes up with is to say we need more deregulation, privatization, union busting, and the race to the bottom. So they're basically saying, we're locked into these policies, and if the policies are failing, the only answer is to get more and more and more radical application of the failed policies, and maybe we will then get a turnaround. Let's just take a couple of examples of the bankruptcy and degeneracy and decadence of the Anglo-American ruling elite, which I think is the big story coming out of 2008. Let's look, first of all, at the endowments. Now, naturally, to be an oligarch, you've got to have money. Otherwise, what kind of an oligarch are you? It is possible to imagine oligarchical systems based on heredity or family lineage, but generally money trumps it. And especially in Britain, if you go to Britain in the 1700s, people say, well, this society claims to be based on the possession of titles of nobility, but in reality, there's no society where money is such a naked meter of what you represent. This is pointed out by Lewis Bromfield, the American novelist in the 1930s and 1940s. Lewis Bromfield, a significant writer, pretty much a contemporary of Sinclair Lewis. Now, let's look at the Harvard Endowment and the Yale Endowment. These are a couple of the ones that we have some statistics for. These are obviously key institutions of the ruling class. It is a ruling class. It is a ruling elite. And they've got a Harvard Endowment of about, when it started, it was approaching $40 billion up until about 6 months ago. At least this is what they tell us. And they then, because of their exposure to the world derivatives crisis, the world stock market panic, and other events of, in particular, the second half of 2008, they've lost an immediate 22 to 25% of the Harvard Endowment, but it's very, very likely that that will get you up to 30, maybe 35%. In other words, it's going to be between a quarter, and that's the low end, to a third, which I think is the realistic estimate, of the entire Harvard Endowment is going to be wiped out in 1 year. Now, over at Yale, the situation is not much better. Yale Endowment slightly less, but they have also announced, they've announced immediately that they lost 25%. So the Harvard announcement is 22% to start with. The Yale Endowment says we've lost 25%. Now, let's see in a minute why this state of affairs points to a decadence and degeneracy of an entire ruling elite.
Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. We're discussing the question of oligarchy, the decadence and degeneracy of the Anglo-American ruling class as a class, which poses a very, very severe crisis for the rest of us, because this is an oligarchy that is capable, certainly, dragging down large parts of world civilization and maybe even all of world civilization unless they are somehow evicted, unless somebody forecloses on their bankrupt leadership in the form of new ideas and new political movements that are capable of expressing an anti-oligarchical impulse in favor of economic development, rising standards of living, and world economic modernization. The Anglo-American oligarchy is capable of dragging the entire world into a new dark age, capable of wiping out civilization. And that's pretty much what it looks like. Plato writes, oligarchy is a constitution teeming with many evils. It is the regime based on property qualification, wherein the rich hold office and the poor man is excluded. And in the Republic also, he says there are five kinds of government. Again, he goes through these. They're reflected in the souls of the private individuals. One inferior human type, Plato says, is the member of a ruling class, oligarchy. And, of course, if it's oligarchy, it has to be a class that's ruling. For a tyrant, it could be one person. A dictator, one person can rule. Democracy, a spontaneous mob, very, very rare. But with oligarchy, very common, it's a class. And then he writes, what do we have going on under oligarchy? Still Plato in the Republic. That storehouse full of gold, which every man has, destroys the earlier constitution. First they invent ways of spending for themselves, and neither they nor their wives obey the laws, but they pervert them to support this. After that, they observe each other and rival each other and make the whole body of the people like themselves. And what else happens then? Thus, in the end, they have become lovers of money and money-making and no longer aim at honor and ambition. They praise the rich man and admire him and bring him into places of government, and the poor man they dishonor. So then they lay down a law or of limitation in the Constitution. They fix a sum of money, greater or less, according as the oligarchy is more or less complete, and proclaim that no one may share in the government unless his property comes up to the assessment. This they carry out by force of arms, or they have used terror before this to establish such a constitution. Terror can go in a number of ways. But eventually, the oligarchs become degenerate. And here we have the moment where this becomes obvious. Often enough, a sinewy, sun-browned poor man may be posted in battle beside a rich man fostered in shady places, encumbered with alien fat, and seeing him panting and helpless. Don't you suppose he will reflect that his own cowardice has allowed such men to be rich? I repeat, don't you suppose he reflects that his own cowardice has allowed such men to be rich? Will not one pass the word to another when they meet in private, saying, we can take these guys, they're a big nothing? And the problem, of course, of oligarchy, as we read in the Laws, in the dialogue between Clinias and the Athenian, is that the oligarchy is the hardest to reform. The purpose of an oligarchy is only one thing, perpetuate oligarchy. A tyrant, a dictator, a Peter the Great, a Dionysios of Syracuse, just to name a couple, can sometimes be convinced. Even Frederick the Great, not a great guy, but did some things. You can convince a dictator or a tyrant to do things that are extremely useful, might not be able to get done any other way. But in an oligarchy, it's just about impossible to convince the oligarchy to launch out on a policy which is radically different from what they've done. So Clinias says in the Laws of Plato, the best state, I understand you, might arise out of an autocracy, provided there were a consummate legislator and an autocrat of disciplined character, and the transition to it would be particularly easy and rapid in that case. Less so from an oligarchy. Is that not your meaning? And still less from a democracy. So he says, the difficulty, the Athenian responds, that the greatest difficulty is to reform an oligarchy. for there the number of persons of influence is the greatest. Well, this seems to be pretty much what we have, a civilization which is pitching into the abyss, and they don't know what to do with it. And let's get back to the question of the endowments. You have to assume, if you read the propaganda, you know, go get the college catalog for Harvard and Yale, these institutions and others like them pose themselves as the repositories of human wisdom. In other words, they know everything that is worth knowing. But then in practical terms, we see that their money, which is what means the most to them, there's something that they have exposed to derivatives and to stock market speculation and to stock jobbing and to other forms of absolutely destructive economic activity. And now they're paying the price by losing between one quarter and one third, and maybe more before this is all over, of their precious endowments. So this is a very interesting commentary. The sum total of all the alleged wisdom and knowledge accumulated by Harvard and Yale comes down to the fact that they don't have the brains to avoid losing 25 to 30, 35% of their entire endowment. So it means that there's an epistemological problem here. In other words, a problem of knowledge. They're not able to know what to do. They have, you know, all kinds of books, publications, learned journals, lectures, libraries, institutes. The list goes on and on. But when it comes to knowing what to do in an economic crisis, they're intellectually bankrupt, and indeed, to some degree, they're going to become financially bankrupt. I mean, if this is a bank, this were a bank, Harvard, let's say, if a bank loses 10 to 12% of its assets, if it has 10 to 12% of its assets as non-performing loans, that bank, by most measures, is bankrupt. That would mean that most of the banks in Wall Street are bankrupt. So there's one. Now let's look then at the treatment of the banks for the TARP, the Troubled Assets Relief Program. Personal insult to me to call it that, but the TARP. The way that this was done, of course, was $700 billion was extorted from the Treasury by Paulson, Bush, Geithner, Volcker, and the rest of these people. A lot of them are going to be with you again under the Barkey-Obama regime. And they got it immediately. The bankers got it immediately. Let's contrast that to what happened with the Detroit automakers when they needed about 2 to 3% of the same sum.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Webster Tarpley, this is our last program of 2008, so we want to call your attention in particular to two books, Obama, The Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate, available at Amazon.com, and Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography, also available at Amazon.com. These books, interestingly enough, in Germany, Obama, The Postmodern Coup, in the form of Obama, wie ein US-Präsident gemacht wird. That German edition has been selling very, very well. It is, generally speaking, it's the leading critical study of Obama, to be sure, in a book market where otherwise the books are things like America's New Hope, Obama, or Obama, the Black Kennedy, or Obama's two books, probably ghostwritten by our dear friend Bill Ayers, of the Weathermen, the terrorist, bomber, and butcher, that is to say, Dreams of My Father and the Audacity of Hope, otherwise known as the Mendacity of Dope. So those are doing quite well in Germany. There's also a Japanese edition, which is doing even better, especially this past Christmas week when the German market went over to Visions of Sugar Plum Fairies to some extent. In Japan, people a little bit more clear-headed around this time of year, so it's hovering in the 300s, let's say, on on Amazon of Japan. It's also there, the leading critical study of Obama. It's important because these are two countries that Obama is going to need to dupe. Remember the 200,000 German lemmings who showed up at the Brandenburg Gate when Barkey made his triumphal imperial visitation tour then. I hope that we could reduce the possibility of such degrading and humiliating moments for the German people. But we're talking about the bankruptcy, moral, intellectual, and financial, of the U.S.-British ruling class. It is a ruling oligarchy. Don't be afraid of the term class. Again, it goes right back to Plato. It's been with us for 2,500 years, and it's essential. You don't get anywhere without the consideration of class. Now, of course, there's class and class. One of the websites yesterday had an essay up about an interview with Michael Parenti, and Michael Parenti says that he represents a quasi-Marxist class analysis. And then it turns out that the guy he's talking to is a vegetarian, I guess a vegan. He's an animal rights activist, and he, of course, is Malthusian in the extreme. He wants basically both of them agree that science and technology are bad, and that the only thing to do is to stop the looting of the planet. So essentially, this is an oligarchical critique of oligarchy from within. Remember, anybody who comes to you saying that overpopulation and any form of industrial pollution, anybody who gives you that argument, that's an oligarch. Those are the two structural features of oligarchy over the past couple of hundred years. You can see it in John Ruskin's essays on the storm cloud of the 19th century. He was telling people in the 1870s, 1880s that pollution was destroying the world. And we've had this again and again. We've had the limits to growth with Aurelio Piché and Alexander King. We've had the Rio Report. Then we had acid rain. We had the ozone hole. Now we've got global warming. And, of course, it's absolutely absurd because we're sitting here now in one of the most severe winters in recent memory. We've had snow at Malibu, California. We've had New England completely frozen over in mid-December by an ice storm. And even as I'm speaking today on the day after Christmas, a lot of people in New England have not gotten their electricity back. All of this points to the fact that, well, global warming is an absolute fraud. It's an absolute pseudoscientific fraud. The reason that it can spread is partly because, of course, Al Gore, the tool of the oligarch Prince Charles, the Malthusian oligarch and Darwinian oligarch, I would say, during the Clinton administration, if you did not toe the line on Malthusian ideology, in other words, if you had doubts about the ozone hole or acid rain or global warming or whatever the current fad was, you would be reinvented by Al Gore. In other words, you would be fired. The entire federal government scientific establishment was mercilessly, systematically, implacably purged during the 1990s by Al Gore. It's one of the main things he did. You remember his commission to reinvent government. Well, one of the main ways to get reinvented was if it turned out that you had any sympathy for science, technology, progress, reason, or anything of the sort, well, then you were out. This is typical of oligarchy. So they believe in derivatives. This is, it's an epistemological problem. The people in Wall Street believe derivatives have value. They sincerely believe it in many cases. Either they don't care or they sincerely, they're either total cynics or they sincerely believe it. Because they say, well, I've been making money with this all my life. How could they not have value? The point is that they don't have value. Value comes from the progressive changes in the order of nature. In other words, material alterations that are brought about by humanity in the form of production. And it means hard commodity production. Tangible physical commodities have to come out at the end of this process and allow human existence to go on. A world where it's simply paper organizing paper, or indeed opinion organizing opinion, is a world which is in the process of collapsing. And remember, the rule for economics is either you're realizing progress or you're collapsing. There's almost never a middle ground. There's almost never the stasis of saying, let's just continue in the existing mode. And the reason for that is, you continue in the existing mode, you are using up resources. They're going to become more scarcer and more difficult to find in the long run. And eventually, if you simply stay in the existing mode, you're going to collapse. The imperative is to realize progress, and that means scientific, technological progress for the benefit of humanity, number one. Naturally, the biosphere is a big consideration, but humanity comes first. And the fact that there are 40,000 people dying of starvation, malnutrition, cheaply cured diseases like diarrhea every day, this is an indictment of the current civilization. We had one very pompous individual in the 9/11 truth movement kept saying, well, it means evolve or die, evolve or die. Evolve for him meant essentially zero growth. In other words, start energy conservation, go into forms of extreme austerity, and so forth. Just precisely the Wall Street program. Evolve or die means realize scientific discoveries. In other words, make scientific discoveries, and once you've made them, apply them on a broad scale to transform society and allow social, economic, and cultural progress. That's the evolve. Evolve means realize progress, not in the form of better ideas alone, but in the form of tangible physical wealth based on the new ideas. So the crisis of the ruling class in this past year is, first of all, they sincerely believe in derivatives. And again, this is the kind of epistemological difference that can lead to not just to fisticuffs, but it can go far beyond. The Wall Street guy says, derivatives have value. Humanity answers, derivatives have no value. Not only do they have no value, they're toxic, they're destructive. They're bringing about the collapse of our civilization as we've known it. So that's one. Harvard and Yale, with all of their knowledge, what do they really know? They don't know enough to avoid losing one quarter to one third of their endowments, which means ultimately that their knowledge is meaningless, that they are intellectually and morally bankrupt. And you can look at the, start looking at the works of the professors of the various departments. So we have a situation where the ruling class is so depraved that they literally don't know what to do. Somebody's got to tell them. We better get ready to tell them. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Here in Washington, D.C. on this day after Christmas, Boxing Day. Happy Boxing Day to Canada and the rest of the empire. Here it's, I guess it's the Feast of Stephen, right, isn't it? This is the day when good King Wenceslas looked out. It's the Feast of St. Stephen, I guess, of Hungary. So, interesting stories. Concerning now the depravity, the degeneracy, the decadence of the Anglo-American ruling class. If you deny the existence of classes, you're simply, you're blind. If you don't see the difference between a Wall Street hedge fund manager and a blue-collar worker in the burned-out Rust Bowl of Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, you just don't have any sociological perception whatsoever. You're living in a world of myths if you think everybody is the same. They're not the same. The whole combine of stuff is different, right, from the prep school or public school or no school that's attended through the various life chances of the individuals involved. They do make a recognizable social totality, which we can call a class. By the way, the best class analysis is not Marx at all. Marx is a deliberately falsified version of class. The best class analysis today remains that of Machiavelli. He said, what do we have? We have feudal nobility, he calls them gentiluomini, people living in castles with private armies. Well, we still have that, people living in gated communities with private armies. Then you have what he calls the patricians, the extremely rich banking class of the cities. Then you have the people. By the people, he means the urban middle class. The middle class of the cities are the people. The plebs, that is to say, people who own nothing, people who are essentially the city mob. He says that's another class. And then you have the countryside. And basically, he says the reliable class is the middle class. The middle class is the center of modern society. The feudal guys have got to go. The bankers have to be essentially kept in kind of political, boxed in situation, so you can make them do what you want them to do. And ultimately, it's an alliance between the middle class of the cities and the countryside that gives the best chance of good results. But watch out, says Machiavelli, for the plebs, that is to say the propertyless masses of the cities, because they tend to ally with the bankers for obvious reasons, and that is the dangerous one. Now, that's essentially modern fascism, is when you get starting with the plebs allying with the bankers and then sucking in large parts of the middle class. That's the danger, and that's sort of the danger that we have right now. So this is much better than Marx's class analysis. Marx's class analysis is that he's writing in the time of the British Empire, when the British Empire is the main problem for anybody in the world, but he doesn't see it that way. He thinks that the problem in France is that there's a French bourgeoisie who are industrialists, and there's a German bourgeoisie who are industrialists, and this plays exactly into the hands of the British Empire to destabilize all these countries. Remember, Britain supported every revolution but her own. So the British were the homeland of revolution for everybody else. In other words, destabilization. And this is the origin of the human rights policy that we've seen with Carter and that we're going to see now in a grand style with Barkey. But let's get back to the question of the decadence and depravity of the ruling elite. Not only did they lose one-third of their money on the endowment of General Motors, of Harvard and Yale, not only do they believe that 1.5 quadrillion of derivatives are the thing in the world economy that has value, they act on this because they give 700 billion initially, and then, as we know, 7 trillion, 8 trillion, whatever it is, some of it's loans, some of it's not loans, some of it will never be paid back, some of it pretends to be loans, but it won't be paid back, soft loans. The banks get it all immediately. AIG, one insurance company, is now up to $150 billion. And the last time I looked, these places like Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, $20 to $25 billion each. Citibank has gotten $50 billion. The banks get everything, and then the three automobile manufacturers come around, and they've got to beg and scrape and be humiliated. And obviously, we have no sympathy for the managers, the Nardellis and the Wageners, who have gotten these companies into that situation. But you can see that there really is a difference in the way that they're treated, that for the U.S. British ruling elite, production is bad. They don't like physical commodity production. What they like is the world of derivatives. They think that the world of derivatives, the structured investment vehicles, the collateralized debt obligations, the mortgage-backed securities, asset-backed securities of all sorts, and credit default swaps, this is where value really resides, they think. They really believe in paper. The Anglo-American ruling elite has built its house on paper, and this, of course, means the collective suicide of these societies, because human society is not based on paper. It's based on food, clothing, shelter, transportation, machine tools, infrastructure, scientific experiments, scientific knowledge, and human progress. So we are now, we've got a usury-ridden, decadent, bankrupt elite, and they're making these decisions. Notice also they mean to institutionalize themselves as much as possible. We already have a Senate, the United States Senate, which is full of people with names like Dodd or Landrieu or Bayh or Casey or what have you. In other words, we're getting the emergence of a series of political dynasties. And we see now that there's an attempt to continue this, that Biden has essentially given the Delaware Senate seat that he thinks belongs to him and his family. They've given this seat for 2 years to a cringing nonentity and toady who's going to vacate it and give it over to Beau Biden, the corrupt attorney general's son that he has currently in Iraq in some bunker burnishing his resume. But he'll be back, and he'll try to take over that Biden seat and make it the hereditary property of the Biden family. And even worse, of course, in New York State, we've got the Senate seat that once belonged to Robert F. Kennedy, currently to Mrs. Clinton. Caroline Kennedy comes forward, Caroline Kennedy Schlossberg, a Manhattan socialite, an oligarch, an elitist, and so forth, worth $400 million, $500 million. She's got the Bouvier fortune. She's got large parts of the Kennedy fortune, certainly a very, very rich person. She comes forward. And she wants that seat, but she won't come out and give a speech. She won't come out and say what she believes in terms of policy. She won't have a press conference where she answers questions. She just wants the seat. And she's hired a public relations company, and she's expressed her desires to the unfortunate governor of New York. Now, this governor of New York, the current one, who replaced Spitzer, is a very pliable tool of Wall Street. His controller may well be Bloomberg, the mayor of New York and finance oligarch and publisher for the finance oligarchs. I think there's a significant chance that the governor of New York is going to accede to the demands of Lady Kennedy that she make the seat the hereditary property of the Kennedy family. So between New York and Massachusetts, it's a Kennedy dynasty that will emerge. But you can see this is absolutely unacceptable. Now, in addition to pointing to the degeneracy and decadence of the ruling elite, we've got to say something about the citizenry, because you cannot just say, well, these oligarchs are running wild and they're depraved and they're degenerate and they're decadent, and that's the way that is. Wait a minute. There are and have been ways and means for people to do something about this. In other words, as Plato suggests, it's the cowardice and passivity of the average person, the not caring, not working, doesn't matter, nothing I can do about it. The reason that the oligarch is able to do what he does is because the citizen is so passive and has ceased to intervene on a decent regular basis into the political process. So we'll be back in a minute.